Ladies and gentlemen, it is a real pleasure to welcome to the Salera Report a longtime ally and colleague, Rob Kirby of Kirby Analytics. You can find him on the web. He's also a very popular guest at USA Watchdog and other websites that the Salera Report subscribers are familiar with. We are in Toronto together and at your lovely kitchen counter. And we are discussing the Exchange Stabilization Fund, which is a part of the U.S. Treasury. I would consider Rob as expert on the Exchange Stabilization Fund outside of the intelligence agencies as anyone. So, Rob Kirby, welcome to the Salera Report.
Well, my pleasure to have this opportunity to have a little discussion about our favorite slush fund, Catherine.
I call it the mother of all slush funds. So for short, let's just call it the ESF.
Sure.
The acronym, the ESF. So tell us, what is the ESF? Tell us how it got started and how it's structured. What is it and how did it start?
Well, the story of the Exchange Stabilization Fund begins with the confiscation of gold from American citizenry, which occurred in 1933, April of 1933 to be exact. And the gold was confiscated, and by confiscation, American citizens were ordered to turn their gold in to the Federal Reserve in exchange for $20 and change per ounce for the gold that was surrendered. And lo and behold, 6 months later, in January of 1934, gold was revalued up from $20 and change per ounce to $35 per ounce. This resulted in roughly a $3 billion windfall profit on the revaluation. And this windfall profit was used as seed money for the Exchange Stabilization Fund, or the ESF. And the ESF was created effectively by an act of Congress. But from that day forward, this institution, which was minted out of thin air, became the most powerful financial entity on the planet by virtue of the money it was seeded with. It was created with no oversight, and it was to have no oversight going forward. And it was operated at the sole discretion of the President of the United States in conjunction with the Secretary of the Treasury. And as such, everything it did was deemed to be in the subject or under condition of national interest. And so basically everything it did was secretive. And it was basically operated above all laws and was subject to no laws. So, I mean, this was an entity that was created with the almighty hammer, bigger money than anything, any entity had ever been had at its disposal prior, and it had free hand to do whatever it wanted.
Right, and it had broad authority to intervene in all the markets, the commodities, the
sure
securities.
Thing. Yeah, and as it was created, it had at its disposal the intelligence community of the United States of America and the armed services of the United States of America to act on its behalf with impunity. And to intervene in financial markets through the auspices of the U.S. Federal Reserve, and specifically the New York Fed Trading Desk, which acted as its broker.
So one of the things I think that is so unique about the Exchange Stabilization Fund is its entire operation is divorced from the civil service employees of Treasury. So it is under the governance of the President and the Secretary of the Treasury, but all books, records, operations are at the New York Fed, and the New York Fed member banks as agent for the New York Fed.
Sure.
And so it doesn't literally exist within the U.S. government. It, as an operational matter, exists within the banks.
Yes.
Right. Within private banks.
Yes. Well, right. The Federal Reserve, which isn't federal, nor does it have reserves, and is operated by banks, private banks, and so the operational manuals, I guess you could literally say, would be buried within the archives, maybe, of the Federal Reserve.
Right. So you have a private fund under the management of private banks that has broad authority under the law to use the federal credit and intervene freely in the financial markets with no transparency.
Absolutely. Right. All with the stated goal of perpetuating the U.S. dollar hegemon, or let's just say the perpetuation of the U.S. dollar in settlement of international trade accounts.
Right. So one of the reasons I tell people that whenever you get a new administration, I look very seriously at who the Treasury Secretary is going to be and who the White House counsel is going to be. Because what you see is when you talk about the Office of the President having jurisdiction, that is really implemented through the White House counsel and this parallel line of counsels you have running through the different agencies of the government. And then you have, of course, the Secretary of Treasury. So the people who are in on the deal are certainly the White House counsel and the Secretary of the Treasury. And because of the market issues, the SEC commissioner is also important. And we'll get to it, but it's very interesting if you see who got those positions in the Trump administration. It's truly same old, same old.
Sure. No, right. But, and I think the important thing that you're pointing out here is all these linchpin agencies are all connected in a daisy chain fashion.
Right. So we had a whole series of other things created at the time that the ESF was created. So let's talk through some of them.
Sure.
Because it's important if you look at the whole financial system, particularly the covert financial system, to see all the different pieces get put into play at a very similar time.
Yeah, as we discussed pre-interview, to other things that were created simultaneously with the ESF, FHA, or the Federal Housing Administration, and the for listeners who would be familiar with the term CAFR,
right,
or Comprehensive Annual Financial Reports, the predecessor for CAFR, which was the National Committee on Municipal Accounting, or NCMA, it was also created in the same piece of legislation in 1934.
Right.
And I view that broadly as quite possibly an accounting framework to account for the activities and the actions of the Exchange Stabilization Fund, and possibly along with anything else that they rolled into it at the same time.
Well, what you did with the municipal accounting, but with the municipal legal and financial structure, is you started to generate enormous pools. And part of the pools were retirement savings or pension funds. So you say to everybody, work hard for the government and we'll build this pool. And they built fantastic pools of savings, also in the bonding system. But you have enormous number of reserves that are building up at the federal, state, and local government, because we haven't hit Social Security. That's one of the pools. So you have these fantastic pools related to the fixed income markets, related to operations, related to all sorts of escrows, and then related to the pension and retirement savings. And those pools are available to the ESF for a variety of purposes, including skimming vast amounts off the back.
And another way to possibly look at it is, let's if we want to think in terms of these municipal, state, and federal pools being legitimate businesses or lines of business, if you had a big dark element you wanted to hide in a wood pile, maybe this would be a great way to sort of merge these things together,
right?
So you can't tell the good or the bad from each other,
right? And another thing, so Social Security clicks in 35, and that's the mother of all pools, because we know they never funded it; they just put Treasury securities in it. But then we also have narcotics, which really started with the creation of the Federal Reserve, start to really increase, although they really exploded after World War II. And I believe, and I think you agree, that the narcotics money is running through the ESF.
Absolutely it is.
Right.
Which, by the way, is why when we hear of downed CIA jets full of cocaine, nobody gets prosecuted, nobody goes to jail, because if the CIA is operating such an endeavor on behalf of the Exchange Stabilization Fund, it is by definition in the interest of national
security.
Because it is the Exchange Stabilization Fund, fund's business to do everything in the name of national security, and no questions get asked.
Right, so that's the legal question. Can national security waive the Constitution? But we'll get to that. Okay, so so World War II was a very important time for the ESF, and we see a year before the end of the war, the Bretton Woods system go into effect, creating the International Monetary Fund, which, if anything, just globalizes this system of invisible pools.
Sure. Well, it globalizes the system of invisible pools, and it also ensconced the U.S. dollar as the de facto world's reserve right. currency, which is very notable. And also worthy of just pointing out, I do believe most people believe that the Bretton Woods Conference occurred at the conclusion of the Second World War, but the reality is the Bretton Woods Conference was held a year before the Second World War ended.
It was a year before the Germans, and then even longer before the Japanese surrendered.
Exactly. Right. So one can only guess that there might have been ample, let's just say, representation at the Bretton Woods meeting tables with people who, let's just say, the Allied world was actively engaged in acts of war with.
Right. Well, one of the theories is the Bilderbergers was started to manage the some of the seizures from the Nazis and the Nazi money in conjunction with the Allies. So it would make sense. Okay, so we know that the Exchange Stabilization Fund at the end of World War II got a massive infusion because we know some, if not all, of the seizures came into the Exchange Stabilization Fund. So money seized from the Nazis, possibly money seized from the Japanese. There are all sorts of debates. Did they go into various trusts, and were those trusts owned by the ESF? But needless to say, there's a huge shot in the arm to the hidden, what we call the hidden system of finance, which is really managed out of this ESF.
Sure. I would just to add to that, I would suggest that the ESF basically gathered all the war booty that the Vatican didn't have in their
right.
possession.
Right. That didn't go to Antarctica.
Well, there you go.
Okay, so one of my favorite stories, and I put it in the commentary that we published for this Salieri Report, is the story of the Dulles brothers. So we have the National Security Act in 1947, and then the 1949 Act is the CIA Act. And that's the act that allows for appropriations of money going to the different government agencies, now 21, that you can claw some of it back invisibly for the black budget. And, of course, the black budget money is a piece of one of these flows that's being levered with the Exchange Stabilization Fund. But you have the Dulles brothers. It's so 1949, the CIA gets created. So this is pre-CIA. The Dulles brothers sitting at Sullivan and Cromwell, who to me is the, you know, if the ESF is the mother of all slush funds, Sullivan and Cromwell is the mother of all attorney-client privilege law firms managing the parallel civilization being financed out of the U.S. government. The Dulles brothers sitting at Sullivan and Cromwell.
Maybe we should just elaborate a little bit. Sullivan, okay. with the relationship, the Dulles brothers, when you speak of them in relation to Sullivan and Cromwell. Sullivan and Cromwell is, I think, as you might have described to me, probably the most influential law firm in the United States of America.
In the world.
In the
I would
world.
Say in the world.
And the Dulles brothers were principals at Sullivan
yes.
and Cromwell. Yeah.
yeah.
Okay. I think
yeah.
that's good that everybody realizes
right.
the direct connection there.
So and you see, if you study a history of Dulles at CIA, the relationship, and Dulles at, so Foster Dulles was Secretary of State. Alan Dulles went in to run the CIA, and the relationships between them and Sullivan and Cromwell continued through. And Sullivan and Cromwell, it's very interesting. When I got to Goldman Sachs, a little unknown story, Sullivan and Cromwell was Goldman Sachs's outside counsel. But they were, you know, it was like they were one. It's the only way I can describe it. And as you walked around the firm and talked to people, you know, Sullivan and Cromwell people were all over the place. They were always there with a card in the building. It was very integrated. And that's how you can tell when you look, and if I'm not mistaken, Sullivan and Cromwell at one point did a lot of the Chase business. So for insiders will immediately ask you who your counsel is, because those are the guys who are carrying the secrets behind attorney-client privilege.
Yeah, and yeah. interesting you point out, Sullivan Cromwell did work for Chase, and Chase were de facto the bankers for the Vatican, the
right.
American bankers for the Vatican as well. And Chase is very well known to be on record, and there's lots of documentary evidence supporting this, that Chase looked after the Vatican's gold accounts as well.
Right.
Yeah.
Right. Well, we see the Dulles brothers at Sullivan and Cromwell using funds in the exchange stabilization to rig the Italian elections and European elections at the request of the Vatican.
Yes. Well, that's... because we're talking post World War II here, and you know whether we're really talking about Operation Gladio, which may very well have been
right.
Literally the manifestation of the efforts of the Exchange Stabilization Fund, I would hazard to guess that these are highly interconnected or linked, or let's just say twin sisters.
Well, it was very funny. After one spate of allegations of Russian interference in the 2016 presidential election in the United States, somebody published a list of 81 foreign elections that where it has been documented that the United States covertly interfered. And that doesn't account overt interference with giving money. So it's just important to understand that there is a long history of the U.S. covert side manipulating,
or taking an active
yeah.
participation in foreign
and
elections.
Domestic, foreign
yes.
and domestic. One of the things there was a great presentation several years ago by Joseph Farrell at the 2014 Secret Space Program, and one of the things he pointed out that the combination of the 47 and the 49 Act, and then Eisenhower giving CIA authority for security for Area 51, which turned out include financing. What a combination of all these things did was it put the intelligence agencies in a position to be the world's most powerful banker on a non-transparent basis.
Well, sure thing. If you're de facto controlling the Exchange Stabilization Fund, you
right.
are the world's most powerful banker.
Right.
Plain and simple.
Right. So you've created this financial powerhouse on a secret basis, essentially outside the control of the civil service of the U.S. government.
Sure.
And outside of the supervision of the courts or Congress. And it has wide authority, including the ability to kill with impunity, and it's off to the races.
Absolutely. And that does actually bracket or highlight that the true prize in having the control position of the U.S. government is not necessarily controlling the White House, but it is indeed controlling who gets appointed to run the Treasury.
Right.
And not so much really or necessarily the light side of the Treasury. It's
the dark side
of the U.S. Treasury.
Right.
It's the Exchange Stabilization Fund that is the true plum that everyone really, really seeks and quests. And
right.
that's why nobody from officialdom likes to talk about the Exchange Stabilization Fund, and which is why it is such a dirty word.
Right. Well, let's keep going. So we get, after Eisenhower is complicit in creating this powerhouse, he realizes, uh-oh, not good, and gives us a warning. And we hear the warning of the military-industrial complex.
Absolutely.
And it's interesting, he tried to brief and warn JFK, but you had a great description of what happened in 1963 with the assassination of JFK by the CIA and Dulles and the New York. I mean, it's the same, it's the ESF group.
Yes.
Who,
well, the people that then had control of the Exchange Stabilization
right.
Fund.
And I'll tell you a very little factoid. I don't know if you've read Devil's Chessboard by David Talbot. Magnificent book. And it basically describes Dulles' history, but then a very detailed discussion of how he project managed the assassination. And one of the things that was most interesting was his whole description of the who's who. You had the Rockefellers basically coming in, and Dillon was the Secretary of Treasury, and he's coordinating between and with Dulles and the Rockefellers. And John Foster Dulles at that point had died, And Dylan was much closer to John Foster, but very close to the Rockefeller. So there's this coordination going on back and forth between Dulles and the Rockefellers, including through Dylan. But right in and around the assassination, they all meet up at Williamsburg for a meeting of the Rockefeller Foundation.
Yeah. Well, and
and so one big question I have is, at that time, not now, but at that time, was the governance of the ESF, how did it relate to the board of the Rockefeller Foundation?
Well, difficult question to answer, but
right. something
I would put out or at least bring up here. You're speaking of, and you are a veteran of back in the 80s of an investment firm called Dylan Reed.
Right.
And here you're talking even in the 60s time frame of Dylan.
Right.
People should be aware that while Goldman Sachs may not have been running the show or been had a revolving door with Washington and with the financial elites in America in the 60s and 70s, or even necessarily the 80s, there was an equivalent to Goldman Sachs during that time.
Right.
And it was essentially Dylan Reed.
I would say it was one of. There were several firms that were very tied in. You know, J.P. Morgan Chase, because of its responsibilities, the New York Fed is depository for the U.S. government, and J.P. Morgan is the lead in implementing a lot of those depository and servicing functions. So that was always a very close tie.
But understand, banking and investment banking
right.
were separate back
right.
then.
Right.
And as we moved along the timeline,
right.
the distinction and the difference between these two functions
right.
were merged.
Right.
And that was with the elimination of Glass-Steagall in particular in the late 90s.
Right.
You didn't need necessarily to have two institutions to perform that function.
Right.
You could roll about the bulk of or much of that into.
So Dylan was definitely one of those firms, and I think Lehman was one, particularly on the covert side. The old Lehman, not the Lehman we saw go down during the bailouts. It had changed. But if you looked at Dylan, it wasn't just Dylan Reed. It was the Dylan Family Trust that owned Dylan.
Yeah.
So if you combine at that time the Dylan Family Trust and Dylan Reed, I would say yes. That was a... But remember, the Dylan wings got clipped a little bit because it was our guy who basically got assassinated as head of resigning from DOD, remember?
And this, here we're talking in the...
47.
47 time frame.
Yeah. So, wait.
And I'm getting schooled a little bit here myself. I have
we
to
all
say.
Are.
But you know, an important thing to just to point out is that you know, people think of the West and think of America as being representative democracy. The reality is it's ruling families, much like we have the Bushes and the Clintons, and prior to them it was other families, whether it was the Dillons, the Rockefellers, or another name that are extremely prominent.
Well, here's what's interesting: Forrestal, who had sort of re-engineered and reorganized the United States Secretary of Defense, had been. Before he became Secretary of Defense, he was killed in 49.
Didn't he fall out of his hospital window? Isn't he?
He did not fall. He was, but he was. I believe he was assassinated. There's a different debate about why. But he had been at the Secretary of the Navy, and his protege when he was Secretary of the Navy was John F. Kennedy.
Yeah.
And there's an amazing photograph of Kennedy going to visit his grave in April of 1963, and you can tell he did it. He was over at the cemetery for another thing and suddenly said, I want to go visit Forrester's grave. And you could see he was fighting with the black budget guys, and you know, he was literally talking to Forrestal about what do I do, because he knew I'm sure he knew what had happened to Forrestal. So
that he fell?
Yeah, no, that it was a hit.
Okay.
That it was a hit, and he was trying to, you know, he was trying to grapple with the military-industrial complex, and he didn't have the the support and power in the military line that Eisenhower did. And so his problem was, you know, what does he do? Okay, so we come into 63, and Kennedy is killed, and you had a beautiful description of what that meant. So if you could just tell us, what did it mean that they killed Kennedy?
It meant a whole lot of things. I'm going to call it the end of innocence. With regards to Kennedy's execution, from that point onward, we saw pedal to the metal money spending.
Right.
As in unbridled expansion in the Vietnamese conflict, unbridled expansion in the proliferation of drugs on American streets.
Right.
And so, as we said, it was the end of constraint, and it was a Donnybrook after
believe it or
Kennedy
not,
was out of the way.
You not only saw the explosion of more of the narcotics, but you saw the explosion of mortgage fraud related to laundering and leveraging that money. And that's when I saw my neighborhood destroyed.
Yeah.
By that whole process. Okay, so we come into 1968, and the extraordinary monetary inflation from all this money printing and debt, what happens?
Well, what happens, that was the when the London gold pool encountered severe difficulty, because people around the world were beginning to realize just how much money America was spending. And it was the French, under de Gaulle in particular, who feverishly was redeeming, because France, due to their trade surplus with America, was building up enormous amounts of U.S. dollars in their trade account. And de Gaulle was instructing the French Central Bank and the French to redeem the dollars for gold. And that led to, it was Johnson, I believe, saying that, you know, the dollar was as good as gold. And de Gaulle very famously stated, if the dollar is as good as gold, then give us gold.
And what we're watching, meantime, is an explosion of narcotics trafficking globally.
Absolutely. That was occurring. And also, this is when the London gold pool was starting to break down. And this is when the U.S. Treasury hemorrhaged gold to the tune of from over 20,000 metric tons to down to 8,000 metric tons.
Wow.
which ultimately led to President Nixon closing the gold window and taking away foreign countries' ability to convert dollars into gold.
That was 71.
Yeah, that was August of 71. But it puts into perspective just how much gold it hemorrhaged out of the U.S. Treasury.
Right.
From over 20,000 down to 8,000. And Nixon knew that if he had kept the gold window open, the 8,000 would have, because the hemorrhaging of gold was accelerating. So anyway, it was closed in August of 71.
Right. It's interesting. Most people think of as the New York Fed and the Fed as the manager of our gold reserves, but it may really be the ESF.
It is the Treasury. The Treasury is supposed to be the holder and the owner of
right.
sovereign U.S. gold.
Right.
Whether that's indeed the fact, we don't know.
So then Ford changes the law, or helps change the law, and it legalizes gold ownership again. Now, it's interesting. If you go back and look at the confiscation in the 30s, the only people who had their gold confiscation were the people who held it in banks.
Yes.
And at the time, it was a very big percentage of private wealth other than land and real estate.
That's right.
So people owned their liquid savings in gold. But if they held it in the bank, it was gone, because I know so many people who still have their family gold, and they didn't have it at the bank, so they kept it, and they never went after the people who kept it.
That's right.
It's quite remarkable.
And the funny thing is, people today speak in terms of if they hold gold, could it be confiscated again? Well, it was just a very interesting side note there, is that If the United States government ever, for any reason, needs to confiscate a large amount of wealth from the citizenry,
right,
very, very little of the citizenry's wealth is held now in gold.
Right.
But where the wealth is really held in today's world is in equities and in bonds. So I mean, if the U.S. government ever had to do a major confiscation to raise major amounts of money, gold would probably be last on the list because there's little to steal.
Well, but the other thing is the people who hold it are the nastiest, most difficult people in the economy.
Yeah, and probably the most secretive.
And the most well-armed. Okay, so then something happened. We go into the 80s. In the 80s, we see some very big shifts throughout the covert world. And we have an explosion of financial fraud starting. I associate it in 81. I think it had a lot to do with what happened with the information that the intelligence community, the national security community, got as a result of the Voyager passing Saturn.
Yes.
I've talked about that. But a series of different things went on, one being Iran-Contra fraud, but the other is the effort to bring down the Soviet Union. Now, I wanted to just mention one thing that I've written a lot about, and it's in the Dylan Reed online book that I've written. When that financial fraud really took off, the CIA and the Department of Justice, and it was the CIA with Stanley Sporkin, Stanley the Fixer, as general counsel, signed a memorandum of understanding. And that memorandum of understanding allowed essentially non-case officers and employees of the CIA or contractors to not be under any legal obligation to report narcotics trafficking and legal violations to the Department of Justice, which was a get-out-of-jail-free card. And at the same time, what happened was the Bush had come in as vice president and took over control of the Intelligence Enforcement and National Security Council under that auspice, and they created an executive order that would allow private corporations to serve as contractors on classified operations. So we have a package, it's like a coin, and there are two sides. One says, okay, all these secret things can be done by private companies paid for or authorized by the government with secret, non-transparent money. And by the way, if they deal drugs or engage in money laundering or mortgage or other financial fraud, no one in the CIA has to tell the Department of Justice.
Hear, hear. and you know, as that period of time relates to, we saw you mentioned Russia, and I'd like to stop and just have a brief discussion about what was going on in the world with regards to the Soviet Union and the Iron Curtain, because this is before the Iron Curtain came down. Russia at the time, early 80s, was a closed economy, and Russia could not feed themselves. And the reason Russia could not feed themselves, because there were a lot of disincentives in the communist system that led to, let's just say, farms being very unproductive places because there was no incentive to produce more. And the real incentives to produce were in the capitalist world. But suffice to say, Russia could not feed themselves, and Russia needed to have limited trade or had to trade with the West to get food. And the only way Russia could get funds, because there were only two things that the West would buy from Russia in that time frame, and that was gold and crude oil.
Right.
And those were the only two things that the West would buy from Russia. And when owing from the great inflation of the late 70s, which came after the coincidentally after Americans were allowed to buy gold again in 1977, and we saw the dramatic price run up, and consequence or parallel, we also saw a dramatic rise in the price of crude oil at the time, up to $30 or $40 a barrel, which was a lot relative to where it had been. This was bolstering Russian finances and was made in, or allowed Russia to become quite adventurous.
Because in Eurasia.
Yeah, because that 1980 is when we had the Russian, or 79, I think it was, the Russian invasion of Afghanistan, which didn't sit well with the Western world and led to the, if I recall correctly, it was the 1980 Summer Olympics in Moscow, where the West didn't participate and boycotted the Moscow Olympics. So the West had a real dilemma on its hands because the high price of crude oil and gold, with gold reaching $800 an ounce back in that time frame, this was effectively giving Russia the ability to finance its expansionism. And so plans were hatched in that time frame to bring down, dramatically bring down, the price of gold and the price of crude oil. And this was affected by largely dumping gold onto the market to knock its price down. And that's where my country came in, I believe, and there's some good documentation, if you want to dig for it, chronicling how Canada's gold hoard was used to help push the price of gold down in the international markets, and agreements were made with Saudi Arabia, being the swing producer in OPEC, to flood the markets with oil to knock the price down from $30, $40 a barrel down to $10 a barrel. And this had the effect of straining Russian or Soviet finances,
right,
to make their expansionist program, let's just say, hurt them financially. And then at the same time and concurrently, President Reagan had launched his SDI, Strategic Defense Initiative, which was dubbed as Star Wars, and this effectively pitted America against the Soviet Union in a military spending race.
Right.
And this was all occurring under a backdrop of Russian, call it their allowance, being cut,
right,
from gold at $800 down to gold at $300 an ounce, and crude oil at $30 to $40 a barrel down to $10 a barrel. And it was this crimping of Soviet finances that ultimately led to the windup of the Soviet Union.
Right. I just point out for subscribers, we did a wonderful Salier report with Jim Norman on his book, The Oil Card, which to me is the best book on the engineering of the oil price to bust the Soviet Union. And I would really encourage you, if you don't know that story, to go back. And if you're interested, it's a wonderful book and very well written. Or listen to the interview with Jim Norman in the Salier Report archives. Okay, one of the things that happened that I wanted to bring up in that period was the Asset Forfeiture Fund at the Department of Justice was created, and it's certainly not the mother of all slush funds, but it's a very powerful baby slush fund when you combine it with the creation at the Department of Justice of an endless series of laws allowing civil money and criminal money penalties, and you've literally created a major Sheriff of Nottingham operation where the Department of Justice becomes a partner with the New York Fed member banks in doing financial fraud, and this is how they get their commission. But it also gives them the ability to run around and seize lots of things before they prove a crime. You know, it's literally a Sheriff of Nottingham racketeering, and there's real evidence to indicate that they're running covert ops out of that fund with the money from that fund. And so what I've always not been able to figure out is, what is the relationship between the Asset Forfeiture Fund and the ESF?
Well, it may be part and parcel to the ESF, or you and I were talking about this before we began the interview. We were both postulating whether it might have been a competing faction,
right,
within the intelligence community that possibly wanted to have, maybe they were jealous that one faction of the intelligence community had at its disposal the riches of the ESF, and maybe they wanted to create their own competing fund or a fund unto themselves that would allow them to conduct operations of a different nature. But all I'm saying is this sort of highlights that which we saw in this past federal electoral cycle, that there were competing factions within the intelligence community. One faction of the intelligence community clearly was supporting Trump.
Right.
And let's just say there was another faction of the intelligence community, which would include then sitting CIA Director Brennan, who clearly was
supporting Clinton
in the Clinton camp.
Well, you know, it's very interesting because when I dealt with essentially an effort by the Department of Justice to frame me, what I discovered I was dealing with was not just the Department of Justice, and it involved money at HUD, so HUD was involved, but you literally had covert operations. You know, so you had the NSA wiretapping you, and you had clearly what I believe was the CIA and their contractors doing all stuff, and you were up against a multi-jurisdictional sting. And I'll talk to people who are target of these civil money penalty shakedowns or criminal money penalty, and they can't fathom that they're up against a multiple jurisdictional sting because they don't understand the history of the ESF. Because you've been having these operations, you know, across the Treasury, intelligence agency, and contractor line going on for decades. These guys have been doing, you know, joint money-making efforts together for decades and decades and decades. This is their business. And yet Americans can't fathom that, you know, they think of these as separate agencies. They can't fathom that there's a sting team all making money by racketeering against them.
Well, absolutely.
Right.
And
who has broad authority to intervene and make money shorting your stock?
Sure thing.
Right.
And what this speaks to in a bigger sense, I believe, is something that you had. It was a concept or a term that I hadn't even really thought of so much or consciously, and it was that of control files and control, and the way you articulated this concept of control files, I think actually it would be really good if you would maybe just give us a few sentences on, because it really meant a whole lot to me when you explained to me the whole concept. And just as a backdrop to this, when you see public figures or people who you expect to behave in a certain fashion or a predictable fashion, and they behave the opposite or contra to what you would expect from a certain person, the rationale there is that generally there's a control file on that person, which effectively, I guess, in real layman's terms, means that they're blackmailable and people are exercising that kind of control on them.
Right.
And a few words on that would be great from you.
Essentially, people do not rise beyond a certain point unless they have a control file. Unless, you know, a variety of different players know that they can rely on them to do what they're told. You have a reality and then you have an official reality, which are separate and distinctly different. And you need each person to obey the unofficial reality, but look like they're obeying the official reality. And their chain of command is not the official reality, it's the unofficial reality. And the way you can make sure that they will be obedient is with a variety of carrots and sticks. You know, so there are all sorts of benefits if you play ball. But then on the negative side, you need a control file. And if they don't do what they're told, you know, the dirt gets dished out on them. And you will see different links and different things happening in the political process, and those are warnings saying, you know, we reserve the right to dump out your control file.
Yeah.
And there's enormous time and money spent in getting control files on people. And it's interesting, if you look at what happened to me, part of the problem was they had nothing that they could dump out. You know, anything that they could dump out would be worse for them than it was for me. So they had nothing they could dump out on me, and they kept trying to frame me. And what you'll see is people in my similar situation who say, look, I don't have 11 years and $6 million. I got kids. I have to do a deal because I can't spend 11 years proving they have nothing. So part of the control file issue is even when a person doesn't have a control file, they can't afford to spend $11 million fighting what I call spectral evidence. Mm-hmm. You know, now, what is happening, which is so interesting with the whole fake news debate, is spectral evidence is not working the way it used to. So it's very interesting. If somebody said something, you know, Catherine Austin Fitz engaged in this, you know, financial fraud, it's got a lot less chance of going now than it did, you know, in 1996, because people, not only do people, not only am I more of an understood quantity, but nobody believes them anymore.
Exactly.
Right. So it's a different state of play. One of the other things I wanted to bring up in the 90s, just touch on, is promise software.
Yeah, well, actually, and just before we get there, this whole aspect of the asset forfeiture fund came on the heels of the SNL crisis, which is worthy of pointing out. And this was maybe the system's way of trying to recapture a lot of the monies that were looted and stolen by possibly different players,
right?
And this was maybe instituted as a means to try on the parts of officialdom, or on the part of officialdom, to try and claw back some of that money, possibly.
Well, I think what happened with Iran-Contra was there was an effort to generate massive amounts of money for the black budget.
Yeah.
And it was considered an emergency. It was like, get as much as you can. Some of these different structures were set up to deal with an economy where massive financial fraud is going on, and you need the ability to manage the process, you know, on a crisis basis. But, you know, what happened was you created $500 billion to $1 trillion of fraud, and then you stuck the bill with the RTC in 1989 to the U.S. government. And when they got away with that, and not only that, made money buying the assets back out. So you finance the asset, you sell it at the top of the market, then it crashes and you buy it back. It's a pump and dump. It's a pump and dump of the real estate market. And it was very, very successful. And I think, you know, if you look at what the fraud that happened in the 90s, they took those models, same players, same models, and expanded it, this time adding the derivatives and stock market.
Sure thing.
So,
but even before that, the abuses that were in the system that led to the SNL crisis in the 80s also produced another an unexpected or unintended consequence, which was the stock market debacle of October 1987.
Right.
And I would have it that the stock market debacle in 1987, and most people, I don't think, would argue, led to the creation of a very special group called the President's Working Group on Financial Markets.
Right.
Some people know that as the Plunge Protection Team. And this gave officialdom a new level of control over the financial edifice.
Right. So what was happening was, if you were the financial markets had grown to the point that the current ESF operation couldn't handle the management alone. You needed more coordination because it was exploding, and was going to explode even more with globalization. And so I think what happened in 87 and the controls they put in, you know, we're watching at that time the advent and the integration of digital technology with trading operations.
Absolutely.
And so part of the 87 issue was, okay, how are we going to manage program trading? How are we going to use program trading? How are we going to use artificial intelligence both to improve our situation but not get surprised or tanked?
Sure. And this is when officialdom was learning a learning curve. They were all on a learning curve,
right,
about how what's coming, because derivatives, you see, were then had to been incubated in the early 80s, and through the mid 80s they had sort of grown up, or were in, let's just say they were in adolescence, and they could see where these things were headed, and they could see that ultimately derivatives trade was going to absolutely mushroom, and they had to start to layer in control mechanisms, the first of which I would argue the president's working group on financial markets. Right. And then we saw the advent of circuit breakers being started to apply to different exchanges, and lo and behold, then we ended up with the election of Bill Clinton, which I think was a pretty monumental date and time.
It was a very monumental, and I'll tell you one thing before we start with the Clinton administration. The Kennedy assassination and the exchange or the extraordinary financial fraud in the 80s, those two things absolutely empowered the creation of a breakaway civilization. Because you have people who now believe they can get away with anything. They can do anything. They can get away. You know, they can kill the president in plain sight. No one will stop them. They can steal trillions of dollars in plain sight. No one will stop them. So you now have a group of people who, and they've stolen enough money basically to finance an entirely separate civilization. And they feel the power of that. And that's why, coming into the 90s, you, as globalization really kicks off, they feel absolutely no obligation. You know, they are as aliens. They feel no obligation to the general society.
Sure. Well, it was the early 90s. It also, it just happened to be 1992 when the United Nations adopted a program called Agenda 21, which was authored by Maurice Strong, and they adopted this wonderful plan at UN meetings in Rio de Janeiro in 1992. And I know all too well, being a Canadian living in Ontario, about the work of Maurice Strong, because Maurice Strong was the uncle of a premier in Ontario named Bob Rae. And being the author of Agenda 21, Premier Rae in Ontario saw fit to inject or appoint Maurice Strong as the chairman of Ontario Hydro, which is the provider of hydroelectricity in the province of Ontario. And it was Maurice Strong, or under his tutelage, that Ontario Hydro was vectored onto a path to get rid of its cheapest electricity generation, namely the coal-fired power plants in Ontario, which made Ontario the lowest power-producing jurisdiction in North America.
Lowest cost.
Yeah, we produced electricity cheaper than anyone. And at that time, Ontario had a very, very high concentration of its economy, was involved in heavy industry, whether it was, you know, mining, whether it was like up in Sudbury with Stelco and Inco, or whether it was the auto industry, which is very energy or heavy energy users. But let's just say that by the early 2000s, 2002, the handiwork of Maurice Strong as the chairman of Ontario Hydro really began to show its teeth, because the hydro plants were all decommissioned and deconstructed and taken offline, and at the margin, Ontario's power was coming from windmill, and so we went from at the margin being able to produce a unit of electricity in Ontario for 6.5 cents to a new marginal cost at 70 cents. So the cost of our power went up by a factor of 10, and lo and behold, look what's happened. We've lost much of our heavy industry in Ontario. Our electricity prices have spiraled up. And isn't it amazing? People in Ontario wonder when the jobs are coming back that disappeared. And, you know, and the answer to that is never, because our grid has been changed forever. But let's just go back and remember what the whole gist of Agenda 21 was. And the real gist of Agenda 21 was to deindustrialize the West and move all that industrial production to Asia. And this has all been a cooked plan, right, by the globalists for the interests of the globalists. And the globalists have largely front-run this whole operation.
Right.
By investing in China.
Right. So when I'm here, I have to deal with the unions. If I move everything to China, I own more of the equity and I don't have to deal with the unions and the pollution can be there.
Sure.
But there's something else also, which is, if I'm now financing two civilizations from one civilization's balance sheet and income statement, I don't want the general population over in the first civilization to use up all the resources. I want to use them over here in the breakaway civilization, and I don't want to have to compete on price. So everything I can do to diminish demand over here helps me finance the second civilization.
Absolutely.
Right. So climate change, Agenda 21, I need lots of heartwarming excuses.
Well, of course. And let's just understand this. When you talk about the breakaway civilization, the real question in my mind is, the breakaway civilization, is it off-world, or is it on a different part of the planet, or is it possibly underground?
Right.
But it to a point, it's immaterial whether we're talking off-world, whether we're talking the other side of the world, or
right,
underground.
Right.
It's we're talking about something that the power elites, or the globalists, as I like to call them, it's what they've invested in. And of course, I mean, we were sold this this whole concept of globalization and these international trade, multilateral trade agreements have been sold to us as improving the lot of people who are very impoverished.
Right.
I don't really view people in China who are working in factories with suicide nets around them as being empowered or their lot in life really being helped that much.
Right.
To me, it's a big labor arbitrage, and it's resulted, the net result of it has been a very few people have made very, very, very large windfall profits.
Yeah, it's been very
unusual. Power and wealth has been concentrated in fewer and fewer hands.
Right. Okay, so let's jump into the Clinton administration. We see Bob Rubin come into the administration immediately as the national economic spot at the White House. He later goes to Treasury, and then he brings in Larry Summers, who we know essentially invented the gold suppression scheme as an academic.
Well, he did academic work at Harvard with a guy named Robert Barsky, and their work centered around an economic concept referred to as Gibson's paradox. And Gibson's paradox explained the interrelationship of gold prices and interest rates, and basically argued in economic terms that the interest rates could be held very low regardless of how much money was being spent by government if the price of gold were
suppressed. Right.
And, you know, isn't it funny?
It was remarkable, because when I kept trying to warn people about what was happening, they'd say, well, it can't be because the gold price is low.
It was
amazing. All over the world.
Yeah.
All over the world. Europe, Asia, everybody. It can't be true because the gold price is low. Anyway, so then Rubin goes over to Treasury. Now, Rubin, for almost 30 years, was at Goldman Sachs, including finally the co-chairman of Goldman Sachs. He leaves behind in the fixed income division Lloyd Blankfein and Gary Cohen and Bob Mnuchin's son, Steve Mnuchin, working for Blankfein and Cohen. And they're running the fixed income division, which is government bonds and mortgage securities and the precious metals, the commodities group, Blagg, Fine & Cohen had come out of gold and silver trading at J. Aron, which was then purchased by Goldman Sachs. So basically, you've got a gold and silver trader, two gold and silver traders with Mnuchin's son, Steve, engineering with Rubin at Treasury the strong dollar policy, and it had four legs. One is the gold suppression we just talked about, the bubbling of the mortgage market with massive amounts of fraud. I also believe that the same happened in the government securities, massive government fraud. But then we have, we have to talk about the WTO, because globalization, the strong dollar policy is the wave that really makes globalization happen. We have the derivatives and the interest rate swaps, which is a particular area of your, it's, I would say if you were a chef, it's your specialty.
Yeah. Well, interest rate swaps, I would point out, at that point in time, much of the OTC interest rate derivatives edifice was incubated here in Toronto. Even on the U.S. dollar interest rate derivatives, OTC derivatives, they were incubated here in Toronto, and some of the biggest books in the world were actually housed in American banking institutions here in Toronto. But interestingly, it was in the early 1990s, in the 92-3 time frame, these books were repatriated back to New York, because the big thinkers in New York were then becoming aware, or I would have it, they were becoming aware that these instruments could be used in a fashion to give, let's just say, captive banks could be made to give regulators control of the whole interest rate curve if these things were deployed in an appropriate manner. In a manner that would be very capable or very much in fitting with what the Exchange Stabilization Fund with enormous resources might be able to bring to bear on the market.
Well, there's no doubt about it. What we've watched since that time is an explosion of derivatives, two-thirds or more of which are interest rate swaps.
Yeah.
And interest rates falling. And so it is clear that the engineering of the interest rate swaps have a great deal to do with bringing the interest rates down to an unnaturally low point.
Sure thing. And when we look at the growth in aggregate notionals in derivatives, we will note that the curve in the growth of aggregates starts to go from a very, very, very shallow slope to a steeper slope right at the time when the United States takes their seats on the board of directors of the Bank for International Settlements, which is right, the central bank of central banks, which is also quite coincident with the timing of Clinton coming to power, Rubin and Summers coming to Treasury, And then very shortly thereafter, in the 1998 time frame, we saw the repeal of the Glass-Steagall Act,
huge,
which really took the bridle off, because they went quite the growth in derivatives went quite parabolic after the elimination of Glass-Steagall, which basically allowed the investment banks to
right,
go hog wild in the derivatives trade.
Right.
And it effectively, I would argue that it effectively gave the Exchange Stabilization Fund more counterparties to
right,
conduct this trade through.
And here's why this is important. So we're looking at a process where, with a variety of these mechanisms, we dramatically we create the financial capacity to do a global strong dollar policy. With the Uruguay round of GATT and the creation of the WTO in 1995, we create the legal basis in the trade agreements and NAFTA to push out globally. And then there is a third stool, which is disaster capitalism. You know, the strong dollar policy, by moving the dollar up, gives us you know, and pushing the stock market up. So we have higher PEs and we have very valuable currency with which to buy. The covert operations smashed the price down.
I think I'm saying the same thing, slightly different tone of language. Strong dollar policy makes foreign assets cheap.
Right. But here's what's unbelievable. The strong dollar policy made foreign assets cheap, but that wasn't good enough for them. They wanted to smash down. I mean, the covert operations went in and smashed the Soviet Union and made them much cheaper. In other words, 10 cents on the dollar wasn't good enough. They wanted a penny on the dollar.
Sure.
I mean, if you look at what we did in East Asia, pulling credit from East Asia, smashing everything down, and part of it wasn't just lowering the price. You know, there were countries where you weren't allowed, foreign investors weren't allowed to buy. But when we finished smashing it, they changed the laws.
Sure. And then the pieces are bought, as you say, for pennies on the dollar. Look, we saw the same operation occur in the aftermath of the breakup of the former Soviet Union, where oligarchs effectively bought the pieces from the rubble of the former Soviet Union for pennies on the dollar.
Right.
And this is something that I would hazard to guess enraged Putin. And maybe is something which put Putin on a course to not be too friendly with globalism.
We have a great series of interviews with Ann Williamson, who was a Wall Street Journal reporter who documented, quote, the rape of Russia. And, you know, Steve Pachesnik takes credit in his interviews for helping to design and implement that.
Oh, yes. Yeah. Yeah. No. Yeah. That's one of his...
babies. One of the most important dates, I believe, in the history of the exchange stabilization is 1995. Because on the Mexican bailouts, Rubin took money out of the ASF for the Mexican bailouts. And I think that set off huge alarm bells.
Sure thing.
Because the rule was you couldn't dip into the covert money for the overt. And it was a failure of what they considered to be their internal financial controls. And I think scared them to death.
Yeah.
And that's when, you know, I had the president of CalPERS, the largest pension fund in the country, say to me, they've given up on the country. They're moving all the money out in the fall. And he attributed that to the failure of the budget deal in 1995. But I don't think it was the failure of the budget deal. I think it was the fact that they dipped into the ESF. And that's when they said, okay, we can't trust the system to protect that line, and we need to start doing something now.
Yeah. Well, 1998 was absolutely a time when accounting tricks that was completely an accounting trick on the part of Rubin to access funds that had previously never been touched.
Well, that was 95 when he touched it.
Yeah, yeah. But I mean this is what led to and here again we get to the laws or the theory of unintended consequences. So what happens shortly in the aftermath of this breach? We see derivatives continue to vector up again. Shortly thereafter, we saw the repeal of Glass-Steagall. And shortly after then, we saw, we first had the Mexican crisis, but then we saw the debacle with long-term capital management.
Right.
And long-term capital management was another very, very significant point in time, because what that involved was, and it's been inaccurately stated by an awful lot of market observers and market participants, because what really occurred in the long-term capital issue was long-term capital management's legal counsel at the time was a fellow by the name of James Rickards, and long-term capital had a client. They had many clients, but one client in particular was the Bank of Italy. And the Bank of Italy was having trouble qualifying with their sovereign finances for inclusion in the euro under Maastricht Treaty guidelines. And Maastricht Treaty guidelines said that their sovereign finances had to be, in terms of debt to GDP, had to be in a very, very tight band. And Italy was close to qualifying, but didn't quite qualify. And one thing that was causing Italy a great deal of difficulty at the time was they had a very significant sovereign gold reserve. And unlike America, who held all the gold on their books at a very, very low price, the gold on the books of the Bank of Italy and for the Italian government as a national resource, their gold was marked to market. And with the price of gold fluctuating and actually being under attack in the late 90s time frame under this gold price suppression scheme, it was causing Italy big problems. Because instead of their having their financial condition solidified, this gold component was causing them problems.
Right.
And at the time, their finance minister was a chap by the name of Mario Draghi. And Mr. Draghi was not pleased with the way the gold was performing on their national balance sheet. And of course, they had financial advisors who at the time were Goldman Sachs, who were one of their chief financial advisors. And it was under advisement of Goldman Sachs that Mr. Draghi was convinced that if he were to lease some sovereign Italian gold, and invest the proceeds with a company called Long Term Capital, he could reasonably expect to make superior returns. And with these superior returns, it would help Italy over the hump to have them qualify legitimately for inclusion in the euro. Well, what indeed happened was Italy did lease gold, and when they lease gold, it leaves the vault, and it's sold into the market. And the proceeds are then used to make the investment. So the investment was made in Long-Term Capital. And then Long-Term Capital blew up. And had there been a public workout of Long-Term Capital management, it would have become very evident that Italy had leased the gold, and then the gold was gone, and then they had taken the proceeds and invested the proceeds with Long-Term Capital. Now the money was gone. And had that been allowed to become public knowledge, Italy would have been disqualified in financial terms for inclusion in the euro.
And they'd be much better off today.
And I would argue the euro under such a situation would have been stillborn. It wouldn't have happened. And you see, that was diametrically opposed to the globalist agenda. Because the creation of the Eurozone is largely viewed by the globalists as a stepping stone to one world government, which
right.
is their ultimate goal. And you couldn't have the Euro fail. So this is why this all had to be hushed up. And this is why back in the time frame when the folks at GATA started speaking about the possibility, and it wasn't just the folks at GATA, because the people that actually first mentioned that there was a, and it was incorrectly characterized, but it was spoken by John Emery and Andrew Hepburn in a treatise that they created, a brilliant piece of research, where they talked about the long-term capital debacle. And they said that there might have been involved a gold short. And this was talk in the gold bug community that there was a big gold short involved in the long-term capital blow-up. Well, the reality was there was never a gold short. And a lot of people...
Who had leased the gold?
The Bank of Italy. So it wasn't...
No, but who was on the other side of it? Who was legally responsible to return it on the lease?
Well, we don't really know because the people at Goldman Sachs certainly do know because they were the bullion bank who arranged the lease.
Although if you read the books on the workout of long-term capital management, the implication is Goldman skimmed them.
Well, I don't think it's necessarily a question. Well, I mean, we don't know who bought the gold or who the recipient.
No, I don't mean skimmed the gold, skimmed the workout. So Goldman had control of the portfolio and sweetened their own balance sheet with the execution.
Well, I mean, they made enormous fees from making this sort of arrangement. But the interesting thing was that when the lease was done, the gold left the Italian vault, and some very interesting things happened in the aftermath of this. Italy became a signatory to the Washington Agreements on Gold, which was basically a scheduled dishoarding of gold by different players in Europe. Under the Washington Agreement 1 and 2, Italy was a signatory both times, but Italy never gave 1 ounce of gold or sold 1 ounce of gold under the Washington Agreement.
They already given.
Because they had already given their 400 metric tons that they lost in this and it was none other than James Rickards who was accusing Gatta of falsely making claims that long-term capital was involved in a shorting of gold, and he produced an affidavit saying that long-term capital has never traded in gold, has no position in gold, and he was demanding retractions from Gatta, because Gatta had never accused anyone of anything. They were reporting what people were talking about.
Right.
And the reality is James Rickards absolutely knew that of course he was correct in saying that long-term capital had nothing to do with gold themselves, but he would have been absolutely aware as he proclaims himself that he was the point man for the workout of long-term capital. The reason he had to be the point man for the workout of long-term capital is he was aware of the intimate details that Italy leased gold.
So I'm going to rein you back and pull us back to the ESF.
Yeah.
Yeah. So the other thing that we see happening right in 1998 is money starts to disappear from the U.S. government for fiscal 1998. And we're talking about what is now that we can count $11 trillion.
Is it only 11?
We don't know, because I'm just talking about what we know in terms of official government documents. We've never had a successful audit of U.S. government. And I think one reason is clearly DOD, but another reason is the ESF.
Absolutely.
I don't think the U.S. government and the Treasury can pass an audit. We were talking earlier about Paul O'Neill's resignation, abrupt resignation, and I think part of it related to the fact that he was trying to bring transparency. And if you try and bring transparency around the debt, then you end up with the ESF and they can't tolerate it. It was more ESF protection. Anyway, so we're off and running in the 90s with what is this explosion of financial fraud with the strong dollar policy and the bring down of Glass-Steagall. And then we come in, it gets added with the stock market, with the internet stock bubble, huge fraud in the equities market, pump and dump of the equity market, and then we get the popping of the internet bubble. You know, suddenly Silicon Valley is bringing all sorts of transparency to everything, and then they get pumped and dumped, and they all turn out to be controlled by defense contractors. It was a very interesting flip. So we come into 2001, and I'm part of a group of people who are bringing a lot of transparency to the missing money. September 10th, we have Rumsfeld stand up and admit, yes, there's $2.3 trillion missing from the federal government. I make the mistake of saying to the lead reporter, they'll never stop the story now. And of course, the next day, and I'm at this point saying there's been a financial coup d'etat. There's been a financial coup d'etat. And, you know, because whether it's the financial fraud, whether it's the missing money from government, so I'm trying to get people or warn people there's financial, massive financial fraud. So then 9/11 happens, and we have, you know, in one hand, 9/11 is basically a knowledge management event.
Absolutely.
Okay, so tell us about 9/11 as a knowledge management event. You know, the world's biggest deletion of financial fraud.
So what has 9/11 brought to the table? From 9/11, we have been delivered a new bogeyman. And the new bogeyman is men that wear white sheets. It is a fear of an Islamic bogeyman. 9/11 brought us the destruction of evidence of everything from malfeasance concerning Enron to every other SEC investigation that was ongoing at the time, of which there was an awful lot of in the early 2000s and in the late 90s. All this evidence was housed in Building Number 7, which collapsed at free fall speed as well, which was never hit by planes. 9/11 brought the destruction of Cantor Fitzgerald, the world's largest broker of U.S. government securities, which occupied the top five floors of one of the World Trade Towers, and the records of trading of U.S. government securities, which number in amounts that are trillions upon trillions. It brought us insurance fraud because the World Trade Center buildings were insured for very, very, very large sums of money.
Just bring up one thing?
Sure thing.
It also brought down the old Solomon trading floor, which was Warren Buffett's mortgage securities operation.
Sure. Right. But to wrap that all into the insurance fraud. And what it also did is it dispelled the notion, because people at that time were expecting a peace dividend from the wrap-up of the Cold War, and the peace dividend never got delivered. And it's because when you get a new bogeyman, nobody wants the peace dividend anymore.
You can go to war.
Yeah. So it's the perpetuation of this war model, which you've spoken so frequently about, Catherine, and what it allows is for more and more wealth to be concentrated and for more and more wealth to be accruing to this dark hole that we refer to as the Exchange Stabilization Fund.
Right.
So I would say all these factors were wrapped up, and you know, and then there's also the aspect of, were entities associated with the Exchange Stabilization Fund front-running and actually trading on prior knowledge?
I believe so.
Of the coming event?
I believe so.
Because we know that there was unusual trading in airline stocks, of the airlines that were involved in of these specific planes that crashed into the World Trade Center. We know that there was suspicious trading, I believe, in some of the insurance companies, in the options and in the futures of some of these equities that were involved, you know, firsthand. So what we have is a complete and utter steaming mess. And then, of course, there was also widespread reports of vast sums of physical gold bullion that were stored in the bowels of the World Trade Center,
right,
which were missing when they finally got through clearing the debris.
Right.
So, you know, that's quite a pizza menu. you can pick your pieces and what did that all lead to? So that all led to further injections of, or the rationale for further injections of cash or quantitative easing, or keeping interest rates low for longer, which then perpetuated yet another bubble, which was the mortgage bubble.
Well, the mortgage bubble was started in 94. They started engineering in 94, and it was happening all into the 90s, but then it exploded.
It was goosed and put into hyperdrive.
Right.
Because what we really saw in the aftermath of 9/11 was the widespread advent of subprime mortgages.
Right. And predatory lending and subprime mortgages was a serious problem in 98, 99, but only in the poorer neighborhoods. Then it just exploded everywhere.
But subprime mortgages, there's another facet to them, which really was the, let's just say, the fraudulent representation of taking a bunch of mortgages of let's just say, delinquent payers and bundling them together to create a supposedly, and as credit rating agencies were happy to hang the moniker on, a bunch of lousy credits put together in a pool suddenly became AAA credit. And this whole notion of pooling bad credit and creating a AAA credit out of a bunch of bad credits, and this is what subprime mortgage paper was all rated. And as history now tells us, Bear Stearns was the first major financial institution to have fallout in the subprime crisis, or the subprime crisis was really precipitated from a failure at Bear Stearns, where they had three hedge funds that were loaded to the gills with this subprime mortgage paper, mortgage-backed securities, which were rated AAA, which failed. And the failure of AAA rated paper was the first time in recorded financial history that AAA had failed. And once AAA failed, we had a freeze in the credit markets, and the bill market froze, and the interbank lending market froze, asset-backed commercial paper froze, because people no longer understood what a AAA credit was.
Right.
Because up until that point, AAA credit had never failed.
Right.
So people were afraid to lend money to any institution, even on an overnight basis, because they were afraid that overnight they could turn into the next Bear Stearns.
Right.
So
trust, you know, went out of the market.
Sure.
Yeah.
And to bring the market, to bring our way of life and our financial system's way of life back from the precipice of a complete deep freeze, we were then treated to a series or a round of what I call electrotherapy interest rate shock treatments, where interest rates were engineered and run down to zero right across the curve. And that was done through a huge application of interest rate derivatives, where no one other than the U.S. Treasury, and specifically the ESF,
could have done it,
right, or had the motivation to do it.
Right.
Because we are talking literally about instances in the 2008 timeframe where Morgan Stanley had put on something to the tune of $8 trillion worth of credit sensitive or credit instruments, which are also called OTC swap instruments.
Right.
But these are instruments that require credit. And, you know, at the time, Morgan Stanley was probably the poorest credit in banking. Couldn't borrow money on an overnight basis unless they went to the discount window of the Federal Reserve and pledged collateral. And yet, they managed to put on $8 trillion worth of these OTC credit-sensitive interest rate derivatives in a three-month period, and then only to see these things roll off 3 months after that. And what this signifies, and the only explanation for this kind of a build and then a disappearance on their book, which is all recorded for posterity's sake, and the quarterly derivatives reports that are lodged at the Office of the Comptroller of the Currency, and you can go back and actually review this. Morgan Stanley was recapitalized via stealth via the Exchange Stabilization Fund in these trades.
Right. Well, it was so interesting because I was on Le Metropole Cafe, and I used to get in all these arguments because everyone would say the banks are going to go down. And I would say, no, they're not. Those positions are not the bank's balance sheet. They're U.S. government positions, and the full faith and credit of the United States government stands behind those positions. They are backed by a nuclear arsenal. So the banks are not going to go down. And it was just a constant war. And it wasn't until you that someone said, yes, you know, those are ESF positions.
Yeah, well, I mean, when I saw these numbers, these atrocious numbers, build up in the OTC swap segment of these institutions' books, the fact that $8 trillion could go on in 3 months and then fall off in the next quarter identifies the instruments that were put on as FRAs.
Right.
Those were categorically and definitively FRAs. And I worked on an FRA trading desk. I worked on an interest rate swap trading desk. I used to trade as a broker. I did both instruments. And I knew that when we had a credit freeze in the banking industry back in 1990, we sat around for a period of weeks, if not months, twiddling our thumbs because banks wouldn't consummate trades with each other because you know, and this credit freeze was way more deep and way more extreme than the one back in the 90s.
Well, this all got affirmed when the head of J.P. Morgan's capital markets...
Blythe Masters.
Yeah, came out and said, we have no unhedged positions. And, of course, everybody said, well, how could that be? And I said, because it's not their position. It's the U.S. government's position.
Well, that was when J.P. Morgan was being accused of trading for their own account to influence the markets. And J.P. Morgan said, we don't have any positions that aren't ours. You know, our positions are all client positions.
Right.
Well, who has an $8 trillion position?
Right. There you go. It must be the Russians.
Well, Vladimir Putin. Possibly.
Yeah.
So what did this all lead to? I mean, you know, the miraculous bailout produced, I mean, a Nobel Peace Prize for the incumbent or incoming.
You know, my theory on how Obama got the Nobel Peace Prize was, you know, we had sold all the European institutions this crappy paper. And so when they realized that it was worthless, he agreed to take them all out of it. And in exchange, they gave him the Nobel Peace Prize because otherwise they would have had to attack the United States.
And I would say that is probably hitting the nail right on the head.
Right.
Right on the globalist head.
So I really believed that the bailouts was going to be an opportunity because it was clear they had, you know, depending on how you count the number, whether it's $12 trillion or $27 trillion, at a time when $8 trillion would have paid off all the residential single-family mortgages in the United States, they bailed out something more than 100% of the residential mortgages, probably by a lot. And so it was a chance to clean up all the fraudulent mortgage paper. So I thought, okay, we're going to consolidate the financial coup, and that's, you know, that will clean up the mess. The reality check is no, because the fraud kept going on, and we continue to see money going missing from the federal government. In 2015, $6.5 trillion of undocumentable adjustments at DOD. That's the highest number in 1 year. And subsequent to that, Lockheed Martin spun off their IT government contracting division. Now, if you're Lockheed Martin, remember, they are by more than 50% the number one contractor in the federal government. They run the information and payment systems for many, many agencies. Controlling the payment systems and the IT systems at DOD is a huge PowerPoint position. You don't give that position up easily. But if that's what it takes to get the liabilities off your book, because we now have $11 trillion missing from the federal government, more missing through the pump and dump of the stock market, huge monies disappearing through the bailouts, more money with the quantitative easing and Feds buying stuff and games going on in the Fed balance sheet. You know, so if you look at how much the financial coup has totaled, it's a tremendous amount of money. And the question is,
Catherine, you're talking about scary numbers of trillions of dollars in missing money.
Right.
And the powers that be, I truly believe, have now are trying to capitalize on the rising resentment as people become aware that they've been huckstered and their resources have been stolen from under their nose. And in trying to capitalize on this rising wave of resentment, we have seen the powers that be, or seemingly the powers that be, now pushing for and pitching it as a remedy to this injustice. They're now starting to push for the notion that we need a constitutional convention in your country to conceivably rewrite the Constitution to remedy this situation and to bring the wrongdoers to justice.
So while they're doing that, Trump wins the election. So I've said there were two factions, one who wanted to sacrifice the U.S. to create the global empire and one that wanted to preserve North America to hell with the empire. And Trump was the second. So the Trump faction won. So hold that thought. We see going into Treasury, controlling the ESF, a member of Skull and Bones, Steve Mnuchin, who was part of the original team at Goldman Sachs that pulled off the strong dollar policy, working for Gary Cohen and Lloyd Blankfein. And we have Gary Cohen, who's now the number two, the president of Goldman Sachs, coming into the White House. So the very team that started this with the strong dollar policy financing the financial coup is now coming back in, presumably to reverse engineer the process.
Exactly, Catherine. It has a nasty odor of rinse and repeat to it.
Yes, it does. Well, the guys who sent the money out would know. And these were the guys who, Goldman was, in my opinion, instrumental in laundering the money back in from Russia. So there definitely is a Russian question here, one way or the other. But you're talking about that very team coming in and controlling the ESF.
Yes.
And so,
let's just say the worst possible thing that could come of all this, I think we share the view, if we are taken down the road where it's pitched to us or pitched to humanity that the best possible outcome and getting to the bottom of all of this missing money is a constitutional convention, I think humanity's a very, very grave loser, because it's only the current constitution and the current rule of law that is going to enable the wrongdoers to be brought to justice and to have the wealth that they've confiscated returned to the American people.
Right. So the money that went out through the ESF, if we enforce the current constitution, then that money and wherever it went belongs to us.
Yeah, and can force them to return it.
Yes. So, or we can own the assets. We can have an ownership interest returned.
That's right.
So we may end up owning Mars or the moon or
whatever.
Whatever.
But if they give us a new constitutional convention and we get a new constitution, it effectively completes the laundering process, where the people who absconded with the funds and with the assets will then own them in perpetuity.
Well, we had a wonderful lunch yesterday, thanks to you, with a wonderful group of people, the Solari subscribers and some wonderful, great precious metals experts. And one of the things we talked about was what could we do to prevent this. Well, we talked about two things. One was, if Trump can't get a consensus in Congress to support him in reengineering the economy, he's going to be forced into prioritization. And so if Obama stripped the federal credit from the federal balance sheet and turned it over to the banks, the danger is this team strips all the assets and prioritizes them at 10 cents on the dollar.
Yeah, that's and one big worry.
That's one big risk. So the other thing we talked about was, how do we stop it? And one of the things you said, which I thought was very astute, and I agree with completely, is we need to encourage a particular kind of scandal.
Yeah. Well, we need to draw the... Let's just cut right to the chase. We need people to speak up and talk about this pedophilia scandal.
Right.
This is the linchpin that could bring the whole control system that we alluded to earlier. This could bring the whole control system down. It makes everyone come clean.
Right.
And if everyone comes clean, the facade of there being any sort of justice in the current regime disappears overnight.
Right.
And then people start dealing with hard realities. Reality. And hard facts.
Right.
And the people that have committed the atrocities are brought into the open.
Okay, so quickly, three things. For our movie this week, well, you know, every week we have a Let's Go to the Movies. Instead, we use the briefing that you recommend from Eric DeCarbonell about the Exchange Stabilization
Absolutely.
Fund.
And you can find this. Eric DeCarbonell manages a website called marketskeptics.com. And if you go to marketskeptics.com and you go to the right-hand margin, you will see a headline that says something I've been afraid to blog about. Any reference in that line on the right-hand side, the Exchange Stabilization Fund, and what it is, if you click on it, it's a five-part YouTube series where it's broken down into five segments, 15...
There are links in Solaria.
Yeah.
In this,
yeah. And I would suggest you to watch it and rewatch it. And it's very, very informative and very educational.
Okay, so that's more to help you understand the ESF. The unanswered questions of ESF, if you could give me your three most, if the genie came out of the bottle and said, Rob, I will answer any three questions you have on the ESF, what would your three questions be?
Who exactly controls it, and how much net worth does the ESF have? I'd say I could even maybe boil it down to those two things.
So let me just ask you a question. Of all the money that's been moved out of the federal government and from communities with government operations like the narcotics trafficking, how much of that do you think is still owned by the ESF, and how much do you think has just been privatized?
My guesstimate is that the ESF could possess in dark money tens of trillions of dollars. And that's my guess. And it's a scary number, but I think they could easily possess more money than the publicly published debt of the U.S. government.
Right. So if we owe officially $20 trillion, it could be more than $20
trillion. I believe it could be, yes.
Yeah, I agree. Okay, the second thing is, what can we do? If we're sitting here and we're saying, look, it's time... You know, we're reaching a crossroads. We either, you know, shift this thing to something positive, or it could really go to a dark place. So we're reaching, things are coming to a head. What can each one of us do? What are the things we can do?
Well, I think we can push a couple of narratives force them into the mainstream. Namely, that violating kids is not okay. And the other thing I think we can do is we can talk about the ESF. Because the people who manage it, I think they cringe every time they hear the name ESF in the mainstream.
Right.
And most mainstream economists and people in the financial
universe...
They don't
even know it exists.
Well, it's either that or they're afraid to mention its name, knowing that it could be a career threatener or a career ender.
Right. Or a life ender.
Sure.
Okay, so we could also work to stop a constitutional convention.
Oh,
and that's in
above
your state.
All, yes.
Yeah, in your state. If your state legislature has not approved a constitutional convention, make sure they stop it. Colorado and Utah just stopped it. And we have a great interview with Edwin Vieira we just did to help you do that. He's a great constitutional attorney and scholar. Enforce the Constitution. I've been working with a group of people to come up with a list of all the different things we could do to enforce the Constitution.
Remember, America, you don't need a new Constitution.
You need to enforce the one we have.
It works really well when it's adhered to.
Right. Here's the other thing. If we're not going to enforce the Constitution, why change it?
Well, if you're not going to use it, maybe you guys would lend it to us. We could use it here in Canada.
Okay. One thing I would say is a lot of the drain of the money starts one county at a time. And so beginning to learn about place-based economics and your place-based finances, I wrote a open letter to my congresswoman, which is up on the Solari report. Anybody can grab it and read it. You can send it to your congressman. But it talks about all the things that can be done to start to learn about how the money works, because all the fraud is one county at a time, so you can stop it locally.
Yeah, and when you lose it one county at a time, the best way to get it back is one county at a time,
right?
Which means people getting active in local politics.
Right. We're going to, at Salir, in 2 weeks, next week is the Precious Metals Market Report, but the week after that, we're doing a live webinar to help people start to learn how to find all the data and start to map out the financial ecosystem in their county area. So this has been terrific. I think you've put the ESF on the map for the Salir Report subscribers. Before we close, any other?
May the force be with you all. And remember, if you're handling something hot, have a tray.
Rob Kirby, thank you so much, and thank you for just a wonderful time in Toronto.
My pleasure.